Chapter 9. London. Alfred Vickery had actually engaged in deception to get a job with military intelligence during the First War. He was 21, nearing the end of his studies at Cambridge, and convinced England was foundering and in need of all the good men she could lay her hands on. He wanted nothing to do with the infantry. He knew enough of history to realize there was no glory in it, only boredom, misery, and very likely death or serious injury. His best friend, a brilliant philosophy student named Brendan Evans, arrived at the perfect solution. Brendan had heard the army was starting up something called the Intelligence Corps. The only qualifications were fluent German and French, extensive travel throughout Europe, the ability to ride and repair a motorbike, and perfect eyesight. Brendan had contacted the War Office and made appointments for them the next morning. Vickery was despondent. He did not meet the qualifications. He had fluent, if uninspired, German, passable French, and he had travelled broadly across Europe, including inside Germany, but he had no idea how to ride a motorbike. Indeed, the contraption scared the daylights out of him, and his eyesight was atrocious. Brendan Evans was everything Vickery was not. Tall, fair, strikingly handsome, possessed of a boyish lust for adventure and more women than he knew what to do with. They had one trait in common, flawless memories. Vickery conceived his plan. That evening, in the cool twilight of August, Brendan taught him to ride a motorcycle on a deserted patch of road in the Fens. Vickery nearly killed them both several times, but by the end of the night he was roaring along the pathways, experiencing a thrill and a recklessness he had never before felt. The following morning, during the train ride from Cambridge to London, Brendan drilled him relentlessly on the anatomy of motorbikes. When they arrived in London, Brendan went into the War Office while Vickery waited outside in the warm sunshine. He emerged an hour later, grinning broadly. "I'm in," Brendan said. "Now it's your turn. Listen carefully." He then proceeded to read back the entire eye chart used for the vision test, even the hopelessly tiny characters at the bottom. Vickery removed his spectacles, handed them to Brendan, and walked like a blind man into the dark, forbidding building. He passed with flying colours. He made only one mistake, transposing a B for a D, but that was Brendan's fault, not his. Vickery was immediately commissioned as a second lieutenant in the motorcyclist section of the Intelligence Corps, given a warrant for his uniform and kit, and ordered to cut his hair, which had grown long and curly over the summer. The following day he was ordered to Euston Station to collect his motorbike, a shiny new Rudge model packed in a wooden crate. A week later, Brendan and Vickery boarded a troop ship along with their motorbikes and sailed for France. It was all so simple then. Agents slipped behind enemy lines, counted troops, watched the railways. They even used carrier pigeons to deliver secret messages. Now it was more complex. A duel of wits over the wireless that required immense concentration and attention to detail. Double cross. Carl Becker was a perfect example. He was sent by Canaris to England during the heady days of 1940, when invasion seemed certain. Becker, posing as a Swiss businessman, set himself up in suitable style in Kensington and began collecting every questionable secret he could lay his hands on. It was Becker's use of counterfeit sterling that set Vickery onto him, and within a matter of weeks he had been spun into MI5's web. Vickery, with the help of the Watchers, went everywhere Becker went. To the parties where he traded in gossip and drank himself stiff on black market champagne, to his meetings with live agents, to his dead drops, to his bedroom, where he brought his women, his men, his children, and only God knew what else. After a month, Vickery brought down the hammer. He arrested Becker, pulled him from the arms of a young girl he had kept locked away and drunk on champagne, and rolled up an entire network of German agents. Next came the tricky part. Instead of hanging Becker, Vickery turned him, convinced him to go to work for MI5 as a double agent. The following night, Becker, from his prison cell, turned on his radio and tapped out a coded recognition signal to the operator in Hamburg. The operator asked him to stay on the air for instructions from his Abwehr control officer in Berlin, who ordered Becker to determine the exact location and size of an RAF fighter base in Kent. Becker confirmed the message and signed off. But it was Vickery who went to the airfield the next day. He could have called the RAF, obtained the coordinates for the base, and sent them to the Abwehr, but it wouldn't be so easy for a spy. To make the message appear authentic, Vickery went about reconnoitering the airbase just the way a spy would do it. He took the train from London and, because of delays, didn't arrive in the area until dusk. A military policeman harassed him on a hillside outside the base and asked him for his identification. Vickery could see the airbase on the flats below, the same perspective from which a spy might see it. He saw a cluster of Nissen huts and a few aircraft along the grassy runway. During his return to London, Vickery composed a brief report on what he had seen. He noted that the light had been poor because the trains were late, and said he had been prevented from getting too close by an MP. That night, Vickery forced Becker to send the report with his own hand, for each spy had his own distinctive keying style, known as a fist, that German radio operators could recognize. Hamburg congratulated him and signed off. Vickery then contacted the RAF and explained the situation. The real Spitfires were removed to another field, the personnel evacuated, and several badly damaged fighters were fueled and placed along the runway. That night, the Luftwaffe came. The dummy planes exploded into fireballs. Certainly the crews of the Heinkel bombers thought they had scored a direct hit. The next day, the Abwehr asked Becker to return to Kent to assess the damage. Again, it was Vickery who went, gathered a report on what he could see, and forced Becker to send it. The Abwehr was ecstatic. Becker was a star, a super spy, and all it had cost the RAF was a day patching up the runway and carting off the charred skeletons of the Spitfires. So impressed were Becker's controllers, they asked him to recruit more agents, which he did. Actually, which Vickery did. By the end of 1940, Karl Becker had a ring of a dozen agents working for him, some reporting to him, some reporting directly to Hamburg. All were fictitious, products of Vickery's imagination. Vickery tended to every aspect of their lives. They fell in love, they had affairs, they complained about money, they lost houses and friends in the Blitz. Vickery even allowed himself to arrest a couple of them. No network operating on enemy soil was foolproof, and the Abwehr would never believe none of their agents had been lost. It was mind-bending, tedious work, requiring attention to the most trivial detail. Vickery found it exhilarating and loved every minute of it. The lift was on the blink again, so Vickery had to take the stairs from Boothby's lair down to registry. Opening the door, he was struck by the smell of the place. Decaying paper, dust, tangy mildew from the damp creeping through the cellar walls. It reminded him of the library at the university. There were files on open shelves, files in the file cabinets, files stacked on the cold stone floor, piles of paper waiting to ripen into files. A trio of pretty girls, the shakedown night staff, moved quietly about, speaking a language of inventory Vickery could not understand. The girls, known as registry queens in the lexicon of the place, looked strangely out of place amid the paper and the gloom. He half expected to turn a corner and spot a pair of monks reading an ancient manuscript by candlelight. He shivered. God, but the place was cold as a crypt. He wished he had worn a sweater or brought something warm to drink. It was all here, the entire secret history of the service. Vickery, wandering the stacks, was struck by the thought that long after he left MI5, there would be an eternal record of his every action. He wasn't certain if he found the thought comforting or sickening. Vickery thought of Boothby's disparaging remarks about him, and a cold shiver of anger passed over him. Vickery was a damned good double-cross officer, even Boothby couldn't deny that. He was convinced it was his training as a historian that suited him so perfectly to the work. Often, a historian must engage in conjecture, taking a series of small, inconclusive clues and reaching a reasonable inference. Double-cross was very much like engaging in conjecture, only in reverse. It was the job of the double-cross officer to provide the Germans with small, inconclusive clues so they could arrive at desired conclusions. The officer had to be careful and meticulous in the clues he revealed. They had to be a careful blend of fact and fiction, of truth and painstakingly veiled lies. Vickery's bogus spies had to work very hard for their information. The intelligence had to be fed to the Germans in small, sometimes meaningless, bites. It had to be consistent with the spy's cover identity. A lorry driver from Bristol, for example, could not be expected to come into possession of stolen documents in London. And no piece of intelligence could ever seem too good to be true, for information too easily obtained is easily discarded. The files on Abwehr personnel were stored on open floor-to-ceiling shelves in a smaller room at the far end of the floor. The V's started on a bottom shelf, then jumped to a top one. Vickery had to get down on all fours and tilt his neck sideways, as if he were looking for a lost valuable beneath a piece of furniture. Damn, the file was on the top shelf, of course. He struggled to his feet, and craning his neck, peered at the files over his half-moon reading glasses. Bloody hopeless, the files were 6 feet above him, too far to read the names. Boothby's revenge on all those who had not attained regulation department height. One of the registry queens found him gazing upward and said she would bring him a library ladder.
"Claymore tried to use a chair last week and nearly broke his neck," she sang,
returning a moment later, dragging the ladder. She took another look at Vickery, smiled as if he were a daft uncle, and offered to get the file for him. Vickery assured her he could manage. He climbed the ladder and, using his forefinger as a probe, picked through the files. He found a manila folder with a red tab. Vogel, Kurt, Abwehr, Berlin. He pulled it down, opened it, and looked inside. Vogel's file was empty. A month after he arrived at MI5, Vickery had been surprised to find Nicholas Jago working there too. Jago had been head archivist at University College, and was recruited by MI5 the same week as Vickery. He was assigned to registry and ordered to impose some discipline on the sometimes fickle memory of the department. Jago, like registry itself, was dusty and irritable and difficult to use. But once past the rough exterior, he could be kind and generous, bubbling with valuable information. Jago had one other valuable skill. He knew how to lose a file as well as find one. Despite the late hour, Vickery found Jago working at his desk in his cramped, glass-enclosed office. Unlike the file rooms, it was a sanctuary of neatness and order. When Vickery rapped his knuckle against the windowed door, Jago looked up, smiled, and waved him in. Vickery noticed the smile did not extend to his eyes. He looked exhausted. Jago lived in this place. There was something else. In 1940, his wife had been killed in the Blitz. Her death had left him shattered. He had taken a personal oath to defeat the Nazis, not with a gun, with organization and precision. Vickery sat down and refused Jago's offer of tea.
"Real stuff I hoarded before the war," he said excitedly.
Not like the atrocious wartime tobacco he was stuffing into the bowl of his pipe and setting ablaze with a match. The vile smoke smelled of burning leaves, and it hung between them in a pall while they swapped banalities about returning to the university when the job was done. Vickery signalled he wanted to get down to business by gently clearing his throat.
"I'm looking for a file on a rather obscure Abwehr officer," Vickery said. "I was surprised to find it's missing. The exterior cover is on the shelf, but the contents are gone." "What's the name?" Jago asked.
"Kurt Vogel." Jago's face darkened.
"Christ! Let me take a look for it. Wait here, Alfred. I'll just be a moment."
"I'll come with you," Vickery said. "Maybe I can help."
"No, no," Jago insisted. "I wouldn't hear of it. I don't help you find spies, you don't help me find files."
He laughed at his own joke.
"Stay here, make yourself comfortable. I'll just be a moment."
That's the second time you've said that, Vickery thought. "I'll just be a moment." Vickery knew that Jago had become obsessive about his files, but one missing dossier on an Abwehr officer was not cause for a departmental emergency. Files were misplaced and mistakenly discarded all the time. Once Boothby sounded a red alert after losing an entire briefcase filled with important files. Department legend said they had been found a week later at the flat of his mistress.
Jago rushed back into the office a moment later, a cloud of the vile pipe smoke floating behind him like steam from a locomotive. He handed Vickery the file and sat down behind his desk.
"Just as I thought," Jago said, absurdly proud of himself. "It was right there on the shelf. One of the girls must have placed it in the wrong folder. Happens all the time."
Vickery listened to the dubious excuse and frowned.
"Interesting. Never happened to me before."
"Well, maybe you're just lucky. We handle thousands of files a week down here. We could use more staff. I've taken it up with the Director General, but he says we've used up our allotment and we can't have any more."
Jago's pipe had gone dead, and he was making a vast show of relighting it. Vickery's eyes teared as the little chamber of an office filled with smoke again. Nicholas Jago was a thoroughly good and honest man, but Vickery didn't believe a word of his story. He believed the file had been pulled by someone recently and hadn't made its way back to the shelf. And the someone who pulled it must have been someone damned important, judging by the look on Jago's face when Vickery had asked for it. Vickery used the file to wave a clear patch in the cloud of smoke.
"Who had Vogel's file last?"
"Come on, Alfred, you know I can't tell you that."
It was the truth. Mere mortals like Vickery had to sign out files. Records were kept on who pulled what files and when. Only the registry staff and department heads had access to those records. A handful of very senior officers could get files without signing them out. Vickery suspected Fogel's file had been pulled by one of those officers.
"All I have to do is ask Boothby for a chit to see the access list and he'll give it to me," Vickery said.
"Why don't you let me see it now and save me the time?"
He might not."
"What do you mean by that, Nicholas?"
"Listen, old man, the last thing I want to do is get between you and Boothby again."
Jago was busying himself with a pipe again, stuffing the bowl, digging a match out of the matchbox. He stuck the thing between his clenched teeth so the bowl bounced while he spoke.
"Talk to Boothby. If he says you can see the access list, it's all yours."
Vickery left him sitting in his smoky glass chamber, trying to set fire to his cheap tobacco, his match flaring with every drag on the pipe. Taking one last glance at him as he walked away with Fogel's file, he thought Jago looked like a lighthouse on a foggy point. Vickery stopped at the canteen on the way back up to his office. He couldn't remember when he had last eaten. His hunger was a dull ache. He no longer craved fine food. Eating had become a practical undertaking, something to be done out of necessity, not pleasure. Like walking London at night. Do it quickly, try not to get hurt. He remembered the afternoon in May 1940 when they had come for him. "Mr. Ashworth delivered 2 nice lamb chops to your house a short time ago." Such a waste of precious time. It was late, and the selection was worse than usual. A chunk of brown bread, some suspect cheese, a bubbling cauldron of brown liquid. Someone had crossed out the words beef broth on the menu and written stone soup. Vickery passed on the cheese and sniffed at the broth. It seemed harmless enough. He cautiously ladled himself out a bowl. The bread was as hard as the cutting board. Vickery hacked off a hunk with a dull knife. Using Fogel's file as a service tray, he picked his way through the tables and chairs. John Masterman sat stooped over a volume of Latin. A pair of famous lawyers sat at a corner table, re-arguing an old courtroom duel. A popular writer of crime novels was scribbling in a battered notebook. Vickery shook his head. MI5 had recruited a remarkable array of talent. He walked carefully up the stairs, the bowl of broth balanced precariously on the file. The last thing he needed was to soil the dossier. Jago had written countless irate memoranda imploring case officers to take better care of the files.
"What's the name?"
"Kurt Fogel."
"Christ, let me take a look for it."
Something about it just wasn't right. That Vickery knew. Better not to force it. Better to set it aside and let his subconscious turn over the pieces. He set the file and the soup down on his desk and switched on the lamp. He read the file through once while he sipped at the soup. It tasted like a boiled leather boot. Salt was one of the few spices the cooks had in plentiful supply, and they had used it generously. By the time he finished reading the file the second time, he had a desert thirst, and his fingers were beginning to swell. Vickery looked up and said,
"Harry, I think we have a problem."
Harry Dalton, who had drifted off to sleep at his desk in the common area outside Vickery's office, got to his feet and came inside. They were a dubious pairing, jokingly referred to inside the department as Muscle and Brains Limited. Harry was tall and athletic, sharp-suited, with thickly brilliantined black hair, intelligent blue eyes, and a ready all-purpose smile. Before the war, he was Detective Inspector Harry Dalton of the Metropolitan Police Department's elite murder squad. He was born and raised in Battersea, and still had a trace of working-class South London in his soft, pleasant voice.
"He's got brains, that's for certain," Vickery said. "Look at this. Doctorate of Law from Leipzig University. Studied under Heller and Rosenberg. Doesn't sound like your typical Nazi to me. The Nazis perverted the laws of Germany. Someone with an education like that couldn't be too thrilled about them. Then in 1935 he suddenly decides to forsake the law and go to work for Canaris as his personal attorney. A sort of in-house counsel for the Abwehr? I don't believe that. I think he's a spy, and this business about being Canaris's legal adviser is just another layer of cover."
Vickery was flipping through the file again.
"You have a theory?"
Harry asked.
"Three theories, actually."
"Let's hear them."
"Number one, Canaris has lost faith in the British networks and has commissioned Fogel to undertake an investigation. A man with Fogel's background and training is the perfect officer to sift through all the files and all the agent reports to look for inconsistencies. We've been damned careful, Harry, but maintaining double-cross is an enormously complex task. I bet we've made a couple of mistakes along the way, and if the right person were looking for them, an intelligent man like Kurt Fogel, for instance, he might be able to spot them."
"Theory two?"
"Theory two, Canaris has commissioned Fogel to construct a new network. It's very late in the game for something like that. Agents would have to be discovered, recruited, trained, and inserted into the country. That usually takes months to do the right way. I doubt that's what they're up to, but it can't be totally discounted."
"Theory three?"
"Theory three is that Kurt Fogel is the control officer of a network we don't know about."
"An entire network of agents that we haven't uncovered? Is that possible?"
"We have to assume it is."
"Then all our doubles would be at risk."
"It's a house of cards, Harry. All it takes is one good agent and the entire thing comes crashing down."
Vickery lit a cigarette. The tobacco took the aftertaste of the broth out of his mouth.
"Canaris must be under enormous pressure to deliver. He'd want the best to handle the operation."
"So that means Kurt Fogel is a man operating in a pressure cooker."
"Right."
"That could make him dangerous."
"It could also make him careless. He has to make a move. He has to use his radio or send an agent into the country. And when he does, we'll be on to him."
They sat in silence for a moment, Vickery smoking, Harry thumbing his way through Fogel's file. Then Vickery told him about what had happened in registry.
"Lots of files go missing now and again, Alfred."
"Yes, but why this file? And more importantly, why now?"
"Good questions, but I suspect the answers are very simple. When you're in the middle of an investigation, it's best to stay focused, not get sidetracked."
"I know, Harry," Vickery said, frowning.
"But it's driving me to distraction."
Harry said, "I know one or two of the registry queens." Vickery looked up.
"I'm sure you do."
"I'll poke around, ask a few questions."
"Do it quietly."
"There's no other way to do it, Alfred."
"Jago's lying. He's hiding something."
"Why would he lie?"
"I don't know," Vickery said, crushing out his cigarette. "But I'm paid to think wicked thoughts."
Chapter 10. Bletchley Park, England. Officially, it was called the Government Code and Cipher School. However, it was not a school at all. It looked as though it might be a school of some kind, a large, ugly Victorian mansion surrounded by a high fence, but most people in the narrow-streeted railway town of Bletchley understood that something portentous was going on there. The great lawns were covered with dozens of makeshift huts. The remaining space had been trampled into pathways of frozen mud. The gardens were overgrown and shabby, like tiny jungles. The staff was an odd collection. The country's brightest mathematicians, chess champions, crossword puzzle wizards, all assembled for one purpose, cracking German codes. Even in the notoriously eccentric world of Bletchley Park, Denholm Saunders was considered an oddball. Before the war, he had been a top mathematician at Cambridge. Now he was among the best cryptanalysts in the world. He also lived in a hamlet outside Bletchley, with his mother and his Siamese cats, Plato and St. Thomas Aquinas. It was late afternoon. Saunders was seated at his desk in the mansion, working over a pair of messages sent by the Abwehr in Hamburg to German agents inside Britain. The messages had been intercepted by the Radio Security Service, flagged as suspicious, and forwarded to Bletchley Park for decoding. Saunders whistled tunelessly while his pencil scraped across his pad, a habit that irritated his colleagues no end. He worked in the hand cipher section of the park. His workspace was crowded and cramped, but it was relatively warm. Better to be here than outside in one of the huts, where cryptanalysts slaved over German army and naval ciphers like Eskimos in an igloo. 2 hours later, the scraping and the whistling stopped. Saunders was aware only of the sound of melting snow gurgling through the gutters of the old house. The work that afternoon had been far from challenging. The messages had been transmitted in a variation of a code Saunders unbuttoned himself in 1940.
"My goodness, but they are getting a bit boring, aren't they?" Saunders said, to no one in particular.
His superior was a Scot named Richardson. Saunders knocked, stepped inside, and laid the pair of decodes on the desk. Richardson read them and frowned. An officer at MI5 named Alfred Vickery had put out a red flag for this kind of thing just yesterday. Richardson called for a motorcycle courier.
"There's one other thing," Saunders said.
"What's that?"
"The first message. The agent seemed to have some difficulty with the Morse. In fact, he asked for the Kia to send it twice. They get testy about things like that. Could be nothing. There might have been some interference. But it might be a good idea to tell the boys at MI5 about it."
Richardson thought, "Good idea indeed." When Saunders was gone, he typed out a brief memo describing how the agent appeared to struggle with the Morse. 5 minutes later, the decodes and Richardson's note were tucked inside a leather pouch for the 42-mile ride to London. Chapter 11. Selsey, England.
"It was the oddest thing I've ever seen," Arthur Barnes told his wife over breakfast that morning.
Barnes, as he did every morning, had walked his beloved corgi Fiona along the waterfront. Part of it still was open to civilians. Most of it had been sealed off and designated a restricted military zone. Everyone wondered what the military was doing there. No one talked about it. Dawn was late that morning, a grey overcast sky, rain now and again. Fiona was off her leash, scampering up and down the docks. Fiona spotted the thing first, then Barnes did.
"A bloody giant concrete monster, Mabel, like a block of flats lying on its side."
Two tugs were pulling it out to sea. Barnes carried a pair of field glasses inside his coat. A friend once spotted the conning tower of a German U-boat, and Barnes was dying to catch a glimpse of one too. He removed the glasses and raised them to his eyes. The concrete monster had a boat attached to it, with a broad, flat prow pushing through the choppy seas. Barnes scanned off its port side.
"Hard to tell the port side from the starboard side, mind you."
And he spotted a small vessel with a bunch of military types on deck.
"I couldn't believe it, Mabel,"
he recounted, finishing the last of his toast.
"They were clapping and cheering, giving each other hugs and pats on the back."
He shook his head.
"Imagine that.
Hitler's got the world by the short hairs, and our boys get excited because they can make a giant hunk of concrete float.
The giant floating concrete structure spotted by Arthur Barnes that dreary January morning was codenamed Phoenix. It was 200 feet long, 50 feet wide, and displaced more than 6,000 tons of water. More than 200 were scheduled to be built. Its interior, invisible from Barnes's vantage point on the harbour front, was a labyrinth of hollow chambers and scuttling valves, for the Phoenix was not designed to remain on the surface for long. It was designed to be towed across the English Channel and sunk off the coast of Normandy. The Phoenixes were just one component of a massive Allied project to construct an artificial harbour in England and drag it to France on D-Day. The overall code name for the project was Operation Mulberry. It was Dieppe that taught them their lesson. Dieppe and the amphibious landings in the Mediterranean. At Dieppe, site of the disastrous Allied raid on France in August 1942, the Germans denied the Allies use of a port for as long as possible. In the Mediterranean, they destroyed ports before abandoning them, rendering them useless for long periods. The invasion planners determined that attempting to capture a port intact was hopeless. They decided the men and supplies would come ashore the same way, on the beaches of Normandy. The problem was the weather. Studies of weather patterns along the French coast showed that periods of fair conditions could be expected to last no more than 4 consecutive days. Therefore, the invasion planners had to assume that supplies would have to be brought ashore in a storm. In July 1943, Prime Minister Winston Churchill and a delegation of 300 officials sailed for Canada aboard the Queen Mary. Churchill and Roosevelt were meeting in Quebec in August to approve plans for the Normandy invasion. During the journey, Professor J.D. Burnell, a distinguished physicist, gave a dramatic demonstration in one of the vessel's luxurious staterooms. He filled the bath with a few inches of water, the shallow end representing the Normandy beaches, the deep end, the Bay de la Seine. Burnell placed 20 paper ships in the bath and used a backbrush to simulate stormy conditions. The boats immediately sank. Burnell then inflated a Mae West lifebelt and laid it across the bath as a breakwater. The backbrush was again used to create a storm, but this time the vessel survived. Burnell explained that the same thing would happen at Normandy. A storm would create havoc. An artificial harbour was needed. At Quebec, the British and the Americans agreed to build 2 artificial harbours for the Normandy invasion, each with the capacity of the great port of Dover. Dover took 7 years to build. The British and Americans had roughly 8 months. It was a task of unimaginable proportions. Each mulberry cost $96 million. The British economy, crippled by 4 years of war, would have to supply 4 million tons of concrete and steel. Hundreds of top-flight engineers would be needed, as well as tens of thousands of skilled construction workers. To get the mulberries from England to France on D-Day would require every available tug in Britain and on the eastern seaboard of the United States. The only assignment equal to the task of building the mulberries would be keeping them secret, proved by the fact that Arthur Barnes and his corgi Fiona were still standing on the waterfront when the coaster carrying the team of British and American mulberry engineers nosed against the dock. The team disembarked and walked toward a waiting bus. One of the men broke away toward a staff car waiting to return him to London. The driver stepped out and crisply opened the rear door, and Commander Peter Jordan climbed inside. New York City, October 1943. They came for him on a Friday. He would always remember them as Laurel and Hardy, the thick, stubby American who smelled of bargain aftershave and his lunchtime beer and sausage. The thin, smooth Englishman who shook Jordan's hand as though searching for a pulse. In reality, their names were Lehman and Broom, or at least that's what it said on the identification cards they waved past him. Lehman said he was the War Department. Broom, the angular Englishman, murmured something about being attached to the War Office. Neither man wore a uniform. Lehman, a shabby brown suit that pulled across his corpulent stomach and rode up his crotch.
broom and elegantly cut suit of charcoal grey, a little too heavy for the American fall weather. Jordan received them in his magnificent Lower Manhattan office. Lehman suppressed little belches while admiring Jordan's spectacular view of the East River bridges, the Brooklyn Bridge, the Manhattan Bridge, the Williamsburg. Broom, who showed almost no interest in things man-made, commented on the weather. A perfect autumn day, a crystalline blue sky, brilliant orange sunshine. An afternoon to make you believe Manhattan is the most spectacular place on earth. They walked to the south window and chatted while watching freighters move in and out of New York Harbor.
"Tell us about the work you're doing now, Mr. Jordan," Lehman said, a trace of South Boston in his voice.
It was a sore subject. He was still the chief engineer of the Northeast Bridge Company, and it was still the largest bridge construction firm on the East Coast. But his dream of starting his own engineering firm had died with the war, just as he feared. Lehman, it seemed, had memorized his resume, and he recited it now as if Jordan had been nominated for an award.
"First in your class at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, Engineer of the Year in 1938, Scientific American says you're the greatest thing since the guy who invented the wheel. You're hot stuff, Mr. Jordan."
An enlarged version of the Scientific American article hung on the wall in a neat black frame. The photograph taken of him then looked like another man. He was thinner now, some said more handsome, and even though he still was not yet 40, flecks of grey had appeared at his temples. Broom, the narrow Englishman, was wandering the office, scrutinizing the photographs and the models of bridges the company had designed and built.
"You have many Germans working here," Broom observed, as if it would be a news bulletin to Jordan.
It was true. Germans among the engineering staff and Germans on the secretarial staff. Jordan's own secretary was a woman named Miss Hofer, whose family came to America from Stuttgart when she was a girl. She still spoke English with a German accent. Then, as if to prove Broom's point, two mailboys walked past Jordan's door prattling in Berlin-accented German.
"What kind of security checks have you run on them?"
It was Lehman talking again. Jordan could tell he was a cop of some sort, or at least he had been a cop in another life. It was written in the poor fit of his threadbare suit and the look of dogged determination on his face. For Lehman, the world was filled with evil people, and he was the only thing standing between order and anarchy.
"We don't run security checks on them. We build bridges here, not bombs." "How do you know they're not sympathetic to the other side?"
"Lehman. Is that a German name?" Lehman's meaty face collapsed into a frown.
"Irish, actually."
Broom broke off his inspection of the bridge models to chuckle at the exchange. Then he said,
"Do you know a man named Walker Hardigan?"
Jordan had the uncomfortable feeling he had been investigated.
"I think you already know the answer to that question. And yes, his family is German. He speaks the language and he knows the country. He's been invaluable to my father-in-law."
"You mean your former father-in-law?"
Broom asked. "We've remained very close since Margaret's death." Broom was stooped over another model.
"Is this a suspension bridge?"
"No, it's a cantilever design. You're not an engineer?" Broom looked up and smiled as if he found the question somewhat offensive.
"No, of course not."
Jordan sat down behind his desk.
"All right, gentlemen, suppose you tell me what this is all about."
"It has to do with the invasion of Europe," Broom said. "We may need your help."
Jordan smiled.
"You want me to build a bridge between England and France?"
"Something like that,"
Lehman said. Broom was lighting a cigarette. He blew an elegant stream of smoke toward the river.
"Actually, Mr. Jordan, it's nothing like that at all."
Chapter 12. London. The skies erupted into a downpour as Alfred Vickery hurried across Parliament Square toward the underground war rooms, Winston Churchill's subterranean headquarters beneath the pavements of Westminster. The Prime Minister had personally telephoned Vickery and asked to see him straight away. Vickery had quickly changed into his uniform and, in his haste, fled MI5 headquarters without an umbrella.
Now his only defense against the onslaught of freezing rain was to quicken his pace, one hand clutching the throat of his Macintosh, the other holding a batch of files over his head like a shield. He rushed past the contemplative statues of Lincoln and Beaconsfield, and then, thoroughly wet, presented himself to the Royal Marine Guard at the sandbagged doorway of No. 2 Great George Street. MI5 was in a panic. The previous evening, a pair of decoded Abwehr signals had arrived by motorcycle courier from Bletchley Park. They confirmed Vickery's worst suspicions. At least two agents were operating inside Britain without MI5's knowledge, and it appeared the Germans planned to send in another. It was a disaster. Vickery, after reading the messages with a sinking heart, had telephoned Sir Basil at home and broken the news. Sir Basil had contacted the Director General and other senior officers involved in Double Cross. By midnight, the lights were burning on the fifth floor. Vickery was now heading one of the most important cases of the war. He had slept less than an hour. His head ached, his eyes burned, his thoughts were coming and going in chaotic, turbulent flashes. The guard glanced at Vickery's identification and waved him inside. Vickery descended the stairs and crossed the small lobby. Ironically, Neville Chamberlain had ordered construction to begin on the underground war rooms the day he returned from Munich, declaring peace in our time. Vickery would always think of the place as a subterranean monument to the failure of appeasement. Shielded by 4 feet of concrete reinforced with old London tram rails, the underground labyrinth was regarded as absolutely bomb-proof. Along with Churchill's personal command post, the most vital and secret arms of the British government were housed here. Vickery moved down the corridor, ears filled with the clatter of typewriters and the rattle of a dozen unanswered telephones. The low ceiling was buttressed by the timbers of one of Nelson's ships of the line. A sign warned, "Mind your head." Vickery, barely 5.5 feet tall, passed easily beneath it. The walls, once the colour of Devonshire cream, had faded like old newspaper to a dull beige. The floors were covered in an ugly brown linoleum. Overhead, in a brace of drainage pipes, Vickery could hear the gurgle of sewage from the above-ground new public offices. Even though the air was filtered by a special ventilation system, it smelled of unwashed bodies and stale cigarette smoke. Vickery approached a doorway, where another Royal Marine Guard stood at ease. The guard snapped to attention as Vickery passed, the crack of his heels deadened by a special rubber mat. Vickery looked at the faces of the staff who worked, lived, ate, and slept below ground in the Prime Minister's subterranean fortress. The word pale did not do justice to the state of their complexions. They were pasty, waxen troglodytes, scampering about their underground warren. Suddenly, Vickery's windowless hutch in St. James's Street didn't seem so bad after all. At least it was above the ground. At least there was something approaching fresh air. Churchill's private quarters were located in room 65A, next door to the map room and across the hall from the transatlantic telephone room. An aide took Vickery immediately inside, earning him the icy stares of a band of bureaucrats who looked as though they had been waiting since the last war. It was a tiny space, much of it consumed by a small bed made up with grey army blankets. At the foot of the bed stood a table with a bottle and 2 glasses. The BBC had installed a permanent microphone so Churchill could make his radio broadcasts from the safety of his underground fortress. Vickery noticed a small darkened sign that said, "Quiet, on the air." The room contained only 1 luxury item, a humidor for the Prime Minister's Romeo y Giulietta cigars. Churchill, cloaked in a green silk robe, the first cigar of the day between his fingers, sat at his small desk. He remained there as Vickery entered the room. Vickery sat on the edge of the bed and regarded the figure before him. He was not the same man Vickery had seen that afternoon in May 1940, nor was he the jaunty, confident figure of newsreels and propaganda films. He was obviously a man who had worked too much and slept too little. He had just returned to Britain a few days earlier from North Africa, where he convalesced after suffering a mild heart attack and contracting pneumonia. His eyes were rimmed with red, his cheeks puffy and pale. He managed a weak smile for his old friend.
"Hello, Alfred. How have you been?"
Churchill said, when the Royal Marine orderly closed the door.
"Fine, but I should be asking that of you.
You're the one who's been through the mill.
Never better, Churchill said. Bring me up to date.
We've intercepted two messages from Hamburg to German agents operating inside Britain. Vickery handed them across to Churchill. As you know, we were acting on the assumption that we had arrested, hanged, or turned every German agent operating in Britain. This is obviously a major blow. If the agents transmit any information that contradicts material we've sent through Double Cross, they will suspect everything. We also believe they are planning to insert a new agent into the country.
What are you doing to stop them?
Vickery briefed Churchill on the steps they had taken thus far. But unfortunately, Prime Minister, the chances of capturing the agent at the drop are not good. In the past, in the summer of 1940, for example, when they were sending in spies for the invasion, we were able to capture incoming spies because the Germans often told old agents operating in Britain precisely when, where, and how the new spies were coming.
And those old agents were working for you as doubles?
Or sitting in a prison cell, yes. But in this case, the message to the existing agent was very vague, a code phrase only. Execute Reception Procedure 1. We assume it tells the agent everything he needs to know. Unfortunately, it tells us nothing. We can only guess how the new spy is planning to get into the country, and unless we're very lucky, the chances of capturing him are slim at best.
Damn!
Churchill swore, bringing his hand down on the arm of the chair. He rose and poured brandy for them both. He stared into his glass, mumbling to himself, as if he had forgotten Vickery was there.
Do you remember the afternoon in 1940 when I asked you to come to work for the MI5?
Of course, Prime Minister.
I was right, wasn't I?
How do you mean?
You've had the time of your life, haven't you? Look at you, Alfred. You're a completely different man. Good heavens, but I wish I looked as good as you.
Thank you, Prime Minister.
You've done marvellous work. But it will all mean nothing if these German spies find what they're looking for. Do you understand?
Vickery exhaled heavily.
I understand the stakes involved, Prime Minister.
I want them stopped, Alfred. I want them crushed.
Vickery blinked rapidly and unconsciously beat his breast pockets for his half-moon reading glasses. Churchill's cigar had gone dead in his hand. Relighting it, he indulged himself in a quiet moment of smoking.
"How's Boothby?"
Churchill said finally. Vickery sighed.
"As ever, Prime Minister."
"Supportive?"
"He wants to be kept abreast of every move I make."
"In writing, I suppose. Boothby's a stickler for having things in writing. Man's office generates more bloody paper than the Times."
Vickery permitted himself a mild chuckle.
"I never told you this, Alfred, but I had my doubts about whether you could be successful, whether you truly had what it took to operate in the world of military intelligence. Oh, I never doubted you had the brains, the intelligence, but I doubted whether you possessed the sort of low cunning necessary to be a good intelligence officer. I also doubted whether you could be ruthless enough."
Churchill's words stunned Vickery.
"Now why are you looking at me like that? You're one of the most decent men I've ever met. The men who usually succeed in your line of work are men like Boothby. He'd arrest his own mother if he thought he would further his career or stab the enemy in the back."
"But I have changed, Prime Minister. I've done things I've never thought I was capable of doing. I've also done things I'm ashamed of."
Churchill looked perplexed.
"Ashamed?"
"When one is employed to sweep chimneys, one must black one's fingers," Vickery said. Sir James Harris wrote those words while he was serving as minister to The Hague in 1785. He detested the fact that he was asked to pay bribes to spies and informers. Sometimes I wish it was still that simple. Vickery remembered a night in September 1940. He and his team had hidden in the heather on a clifftop overlooking a rocky Cornish beach, sheltered from the cold rain beneath a black oilskin tarp. Vickery knew the German would come that night. The Abwehr had asked Karl Becker to arrange a reception party for him.
He was little more than a boy, Vickery remembered, and by the time he reached the shore in his inflatable raft, he was half dead with cold. He fell into the arms of the special branch men, babbling in German, just happy to be alive. His papers were atrocious, his 200 pounds of currency badly forged, his English limited to a few well-rehearsed pleasantries. It was so bad, Vickery had to conduct the interrogation in German. The spy had been assigned to gather intelligence on coastal defences, and, when the invasion came, engage in sabotage. Vickery determined that he was useless. He wondered how many more Canaris had like him, poorly trained, poorly equipped and financed, with virtually no chance of succeeding. Maintaining MI5's elaborate deception required that they execute a few spies, so Vickery recommended hanging him. He attended the execution at Wandsworth Prison, and would never forget the look in the spy's eyes as the hangman slipped the hood over his head.
"You must make a stone of your heart, Alfred,"
Churchill said in a hoarse whisper.
"We don't have time for feelings like shame or compassion. None of us, not now. You must set aside whatever morals you still have. Set aside whatever feelings of human kindness you still possess, and do whatever it takes to win. Is that clear?"
"It is, Prime Minister." Churchill leaned closer and spoke in a confessional tone.
"There is an unfortunate truth about war. While it is virtually impossible for one man to win a war, it is entirely possible for one man to lose one."
Churchill paused.
"For the sake of our friendship, Alfred, don't be that man."
Vickery, shaken by Churchill's admonition, gathered up his things and showed himself to the door. Opening it, he walked out into the corridor. On the wall, the weatherboard, updated hourly, read "rainy." Behind him, he heard Winston Churchill, alone in his underground chamber, muttering to himself. It took Vickery a moment to understand what the Prime Minister was saying.
"Blasted English weather," Churchill murmured. "Blasted English weather."
Vickery, by instinct, looked for clues in the past. He read and reread decodes of messages sent by agents inside Britain to the radio operators in Hamburg. Decodes of messages sent by Hamburg to the agents inside Britain. Case histories, even cases he had been involved with. He read the final report of one of the first cases he had handled, an incident that had ended in the north of Scotland at a place aptly named Cape Wrath. He read the letter of commendation that went into his file, grudgingly written by Sir Basil Boothby, division head, copy forwarded to Winston Churchill, Prime Minister. He felt the pride all over again. Harry Dalton shuttled back and forth between Vickery's desk and registry like some medieval outrider, bringing new documents in one direction, returning old ones in the other. Other officers, aware of the tension building in Vickery's office, drifted past his doorway in twos and threes, like motorists passing a road accident, eyes averted, stealing quick, frightened glances. When Vickery would finish with one batch of files, Harry would ask, "Anything?" Vickery would pull a fussy frown and say, "No, nothing, damn it." By 2 o'clock that afternoon, the walls were collapsing in on him. He had smoked too many cigarettes and drunk too many cups of murky grey tea.
"I need some fresh air, Harry. Get out of here for a couple of hours. Be good for you." "I'm going to take a walk. Have some lunch, perhaps." "Want some company?" "No, thanks."
A freezing drizzle, like the smoke of a nearby battle, drifted over Westminster as Vickery marched along the embankment. A bitterly cold wind rose from the river, clattered the shabby temporary street signs, whistled through a pile of splintered timber and broken brick where once a splendid building stood. Vickery moved quickly with his stiff-jointed mechanical limp, head down, hands plunged into coat pockets. By the look on his face, a passing stranger might have guessed he was late for an important meeting, or fleeing an unpleasant one. The Abwehr had just so many ways of inserting an agent into Britain. Many put ashore in small boats launched from submarines. Vickery had just read arrest reports of double agents codenamed Mutt and Jeff.
They waded ashore from an Arado seaplane near the herring-fishing village of Macduff, east of Spey Bay. Vickery already had asked the Coast Guards and Royal Navy to be especially vigilant. But the British coastline stretches many thousands of miles, impossible to cover entirely, and the chances of catching an agent on a darkened beach were slim. The Abwehr had parachuted spies into Britain. It was impossible to account for every square inch of airspace, but Vickery had asked the RAF to be watchful of stray aircraft. The Abwehr had dropped and landed agents in Eire and Ulster. To get to England, they had to take the ferry. Vickery had asked the ferry operators in Liverpool to keep an eye out for strange passengers, anyone unfamiliar with the routine of ferry passage, uncomfortable with the language or currency. He couldn't give them a description because he didn't have one. The brisk walk and cold weather made him hungry. He entered a pub near Victoria Station and ordered a vegetable pie and a half pint of beer. "You must make a stone of your heart," Churchill had said. Unfortunately, he had done that a long time ago. Helen. She was the spoiled, attractive daughter of a wealthy industrialist, and Vickery, against his better judgment, had fallen hopelessly in love with her. Their relationship began to crumble the afternoon they made love for the first time. Somehow, Helen's father had read the signs correctly, the way they held hands on the way back from the lake, the way Helen touched Vickery's already thinning hair. That evening, he summoned Helen for a private chat. Under no circumstances would she be allowed to marry the son of a mid-level bank clerk who attended university on a scholarship. Helen was instructed to terminate the relationship as quickly and quietly as possible, and she did exactly as she was told. She was that kind of girl. Vickery never held it against her, and he loved her still. But something went out of him that day. He supposed it was his ability to trust. He wondered if he would ever get it back. "It is virtually impossible for one man to win a war," Vickery thought. "Damn the old man for laying that on my shoulders." The publican, a well-fed woman, appeared at the table.
"That bad, dearie?"
Vickery looked down at his plate. The carrots and potatoes had been pushed to the side, and he had been absently trailing the point of his knife through the gravy. He looked at the plate carefully and noticed he had traced an outline of Britain in the brown mess. He thought, "Where will that damned spy land?" "It was fine," Vickery said politely, handing the plate over. "I suppose I wasn't quite as hungry as I thought." Outside, Vickery turned up the collar of his overcoat and started back toward the office.
"It is entirely possible for one man to lose one."
Dead leaves rattled across Vickery's path as he hurried along Birdcage Walk. The afternoon's last light retreated with little resistance. In the gathering darkness, Vickery could see the blackout curtains closing like eyelids in the windows overlooking St. James's Park. He imagined Helen standing in one of the windows, watching him hurry along the walkway below. He entertained a wild fantasy that by solving the case, arresting the spies and winning the war, he would prove himself worthy of her, and she would have him back.
"Don't be that man."
There was something else Churchill had said. He had been complaining about the ceaseless rain. The Prime Minister, safe in the shelter of his subterranean fortress, complaining about the weather. Vickery rushed past the guard at MI5 headquarters without showing his identification badge.
"Any inspiration?" Harry asked, when Vickery returned to his office.
"Perhaps. If you needed to get a spy into the country on short notice, Harry, which route would you use?"
"I suppose I'd come through the east. Kent, East Anglia, even eastern Scotland."
"My thoughts exactly."
"So?"
"If you were mustering an operation quickly, which mode of transportation would you choose?"
"That depends."
"Come on, Harry."
"I suppose I'd choose an airplane."
"Why not a submarine? Put the spy ashore in a raft."
"Because it's easier to get a small plane on short notice than a precious submarine."
"Exactly, Harry. And what do you need to drop a spy into England by plane?"
"Decent weather, for one thing."
"Right again, Harry."
Vickery snatched up the telephone receiver and waited for the operator to come on the line.
This is Vickery. Connect me with the RAF Meteorological Service immediately. A young woman picked up a moment later.
Hello?
This is Vickery from the War Office. I need some information about the weather.
Quite a nasty spell we're having, isn't it?
Yes, yes, Vickery said impatiently. When is it going to break in the east?
We expect the current system to move offshore sometime tomorrow afternoon.
And we'll have clear skies?
Crystal.
Damn.
But not for long. There's another front behind it, moving rapidly across the country in a southeasterly direction.
How far behind it?
That's difficult to say. Probably 12 to 18 hours.
And after that?
The entire country will be in the soup for the next week. Intermittent snow and rain.
Thank you.
Vickery put down the phone and turned to Harry.
If our theory holds, our agent will try to enter the country by parachute tomorrow night.
Chapter 13. Hampton Sands, Norfolk. The bicycle ride down to the beach usually took about 5 minutes. Sean Doherty, late that afternoon, timed it just to make certain. He pedalled at a careful, unhurried pace, head inclined into the freshening wind beating off the sea. He wished the bicycle were in better shape. Like wartime England itself, it was battered, kicked around, desperately in need of maintenance. It clattered and grated with every turn of the pedals. The chain needed oil, which was scarce, and the tires were so bald and patched Doherty might as well have been riding on the rims. The rain had tapered off at midday. Plump, broken clouds floated over Doherty's head like barrage balloons adrift at their moorings. Behind him the sun lay on the horizon like a fireball. The marshes and hillsides burned with a fine orange light. Doherty felt an intense excitement rising in his chest. He had not felt anything like this since the first time he met his Obver contact in London early in the war. The road ended in a grove of pines at the base of the dunes. A weathered sign warned of mines on the beach. Doherty, like everyone else in Hampton Sands, knew there were none. In the bicycle's basket, Doherty had placed a sealed quart jar of precious petrol. He removed the jar, pushed the bicycle into the grove, and leaned it carefully against a tree. Doherty checked his watch. 5 minutes exactly. A footpath led through the trees. Doherty followed it, sand and dry pine needles beneath his feet, and started through the dunes. The crash of breaking waves filled the air. The sea opened before him. The tide had reached its high mark 2 hours ago. Now it was running out fast and hard. By midnight, when the drop was scheduled, there would be a wide strip of flat, hard sand along the water's edge, perfect for landing an agent by parachute. Doherty had the beach to himself. He returned to the pine trees and spent the next 5 minutes gathering enough wood for 3 small signal fires. It took 4 trips to carry the wood to the beach. He checked the wind, from the northeast, about 20 miles per hour. Doherty stacked the wood in piles 20 yards apart in a straight line, indicating the direction of the wind. The twilight was dying. Doherty opened the jar of petrol and doused the wood. He was to wait by his radio tonight until he received a signal from Hamburg that the plane was approaching. Then he would ride down to the beach, light the signal fires, take in the agent. Simple, if everything went according to plan. Doherty started back across the beach. It was then he saw Mary standing atop the dunes, silhouetted by the last light of sunset, arms folded beneath her breasts. The wind tossed hair across her face. He had told her the previous night, told her that the Obver had asked him to take in an agent. He had asked her to leave Hampton Sands until it was over. They had friends and family in London she could stay with. Mary had refused to leave. She had not said a word to him since. They bumped around the cramped cottage in angry silence, eyes averted, Mary slamming pots onto the stove and breaking plates and cups because of her jangled nerves. It was as if she was staying to punish him with her presence. By the time Doherty reached the top of the dunes, Mary was gone. He followed the path to the spot where he had left the bicycle. Mary had taken it. Doherty thought, another round in our silent war.
He turned up his collar against the wind and walked back to the cottage. Jenny Colville had discovered the spot when she was 10 years old. A small depression in the pine trees, several hundred yards from the roadway, sheltered from the wind by a pair of large rocks. A perfect hiding place. She had constructed a crude camp stove by stacking stones in a circle and placing a small metal grill on top. Now she laid the makings of a fire, pine needles, dried dune grass, small lengths of fallen tree limbs, and touched a match to it. She blew on it gently, and a moment later the fire crackled into life. She kept a small case hidden beneath the rocks, covered with a layer of pine needles. She brushed away the needles and pulled it out. Opening the lid, Jenny removed the contents, a worn woolen blanket, a small metal pot, a chipped enamel mug, and a tin of dry, dusty tea. Jenny unfolded the blanket and spread it next to the fire. She sat down and warmed her hands against the flames. 2 years ago, a villager had found her things and concluded a tinker was living on the beach. It caused the most excitement in Hampton Sands since the fire at St. John's in 1912. For a time, Jenny stayed away, but the scandal quickly calmed, and she was able to return. The flames died, leaving a bed of glowing red embers. Jenny filled the pot with water from a canteen she had carried from home. She set the pot on the grill and waited for it to boil, listening to the sound of the sea and the wind hissing through the pines. As always, the place worked its magic. She began to forget about her problems, her father. Earlier that afternoon, when she arrived home from school, he had been sitting at the kitchen table, drunk. Soon he would become belligerent, then angry, then violent. He would take it out on the person nearest him. Inevitably, that would be Jenny. She decided to head off the beating before it could take place. She made him a plate of meager sandwiches and a pot of tea and set them on the table. He had said nothing, expressed no concern about where she was going, as Jenny put on her coat and slipped out the door. The water boiled. Jenny added the tea, covered it, removed it from the fire. She thought of the other girls from the village. They would be home now, sitting down with their parents for supper, talking over the events of the day. Not hiding in the trees near the beach with nothing but the sound of breaking waves and a cup of tea for company. It had made her different, older, more clever. She had been stripped of her childhood, her time of innocence, forced to confront the fact very early in life that the world could be an evil place.
God, why does he hate me so much? What have I ever done to hurt him?
Mary had done her best to explain Martin Colville's behavior. He loves you, Mary had said, countless times, but he's just hurt and angry and unhappy, and he takes it out on the person he cares about most. Jenny had tried to put herself in her father's place. She vaguely remembered the day her mother packed her things and left. She remembered her father begging and pleading with her to stay. She remembered the look on his face when she refused, remembered the sound of shattering glass, breaking dishes, the horrid things they said to each other. For many years she was not told where her mother had gone. It was simply not discussed. When Jenny asked her father, he would stalk off in a stormy silence. Mary was the one who finally told her. Her mother had fallen in love with a man from Birmingham, had an affair with him, and was living with him there now. When Jenny asked why her mother had never tried to contact her, Mary could supply no answer. To make matters worse, Mary said Jenny had become her mirror image. Jenny had no proof of this. The last memory she had of her mother was of a desperate and angry woman, eyes swollen and red from crying, and her father had destroyed all photographs of her long ago. Jenny poured tea, holding the enamel mug close for warmth. The wind gusted, stirring the canopy of pine trees over her head. The moon appeared, followed by the first stars. Jenny could tell it would be a very cold night. She wouldn't be able to stay too long. She laid two larger pieces of wood on the fire and watched the shadows dancing on the rocks. She finished her tea and curled up in a ball, pillowing her head on her hands. She pictured herself somewhere else, anywhere but Hampton Sands. She wanted to do something great and never come back. She was 16 years old. Some of the older girls from the surrounding villages had gone to London and other big cities to take over the jobs left behind by the men. She could find work in a factory, wait tables in a cafe, anything. She was beginning to drift off to sleep when she thought she heard a sound from somewhere near the water. For a moment, she wondered if there really were tinkers living on the beach. Startled, Jenny got to her feet. The pine trees ended at the dunes. She walked carefully through the grove, for it had grown dark rapidly, and started up the slope of sand. She paused at the top, dune grass dancing in the wind at her feet, staring in the direction of the sound. She saw a figure dressed in an oilskin, sea boots, and a sou'wester. Sean Doherty. He seemed to be stacking wood, pacing, calculating some distance. Maybe Mary was right. Maybe Sean was going crazy. Then Jenny spotted another figure at the top of the dunes. It was Mary, just standing there in the wind, arms folded, gazing at Sean silently. Then Mary turned and quietly left without waiting for Sean. When Sean was out of sight, Jenny doused the embers, put away her things, and pedaled her bicycle home. The cottage was empty, cold, and dark when she arrived. Her father was gone, the fire long dead. There was no note explaining his whereabouts. She lay awake in bed for some time, listening to the wind, replaying the scene she had witnessed on the beach. There was something very wrong about it, she concluded. Something very wrong indeed.
"Surely there's something else we could do, Harry," Vickery said, pacing his office.
"We've done everything we can do, Alfred.
Perhaps we should check with the RAF again."
"I just checked with the RAF."
"Anything?"
"Nothing."
"Well, call the Royal Navy."
"I just got off the telephone with the Citadel."
"And?"
"Nothing."
"Christ!
You've just got to be patient."
"I'm not endowed with natural patience, Harry."
"I've noticed."
"What about—"
"I've called the ferry in Liverpool."
"Well?"
"Shut down by rough seas."
"So they won't be coming from Ireland tonight?"
"Not bloody likely."
"Perhaps we're just approaching this from the wrong direction, Harry."
"What do you mean?"
"Perhaps we should be focusing our attention on the two agents already in Britain."
"I'm listening."
"Let's go back to the passport and immigration records."
"Christ, Alfred, they haven't changed since 1940. We've rounded up everyone we thought was a spy and interned everyone we had doubts about."
"I know, Harry, but perhaps there's something we missed."
"Such as?"
"How the hell should I know?"
"I'll get the records. It can't hurt.
Perhaps we've run out of luck."
"Alfred, I've known a lot of lucky cops in my day."
"Yes, Harry?"
"But I've never known a lucky, lazy cop."
"What are you driving at?"
"I'll get the files and make a pot of tea."
Sean Doherty let himself out the back door of the cottage and walked along the footpath toward the barn. He wore a heavy sweater and an oilskin coat and carried a kerosene lantern. The last clouds had moved off. The sky was a mat of deep blue, thick with stars, a bright three-quarter moon. The air was bitterly cold. A ewe bleated as he pulled open the barn door and went inside. The animal had become entangled in the fencing earlier that day. In her struggle to get free, she had managed to slash her leg and tear a hole in the fence at the same time. She lay now on a bed of hay in the corner of the barn. Doherty switched on his radio and started changing the dressing, humming quietly to calm both their nerves. He removed the bloodied gauze, replaced it, and taped it securely in place. He was admiring his work when the radio crackled into life. Doherty bolted across the barn and slipped on his earphones. The message was brief. He sent back an acknowledging signal and dashed outside. The ride to the beach took less than 3 minutes. Doherty dismounted at the end of the road and pushed the bicycle into the trees. He climbed the dunes, scrambled down the other side, and ran across the beach. The signal fires were intact, ready to be lit. In the distance, he could hear the low rumble of an airplane. He thought, "Good Lord, he's actually coming." He lit the signal fires. In a few seconds, the beach was ablaze with light.
Doherty, crouching in the dune grass, waited for the plane to appear. It descended over the beach, and a moment later a black dot leapt from the back. The parachute snapped open as the plane banked and headed out to sea. Doherty rose from the dune grass and ran across the beach. The German made a perfect landing, rolled, and was gathering up his black parachute by the time Doherty arrived. "You must be Sean Doherty," he said in perfect public school English.
"That's right," Sean replied, startled. "And you must be the German spy."
The man frowned.
"Something like that. Listen, old sport, I can manage this. Why don't you put out those bloody fires before the whole world knows we're here?"